There is an intensity to the election process this year that means that, at least I find that periodically, I forget to keep breathing. I really have noticed several times this week that I feel like I'm out of breath, and I'm worried that the pneumonia that I had back in May has come back or something, and then I think, wait, let me just try this. Oh, yeah, that's all. Okay. And I'm pretty sure it's because the anxiety level in the country is so high that I don't even notice that it sort of invaded my being. And so I go to yoga classes, and one of my yoga teachers does this breathing exercise for equanimity, which she always introduces by saying, let's see if I can get her calm. What we are experiencing right now is that a certain set of patterns are coming up so that they can be resolved. Because they are visible now, they can be addressed and cleaned up. Now we will breathe. It is such a hopeful and pragmatic interpretation of the turmoil and reactiveness that is washing over us these days. And it's a theory that I can live with. One of the things that I like about it is that it is both fearless and blameless, which is very hard to be. And she, of course, puts out just those two lines of theory, and then we spend an hour trying to get to that spot for at least a couple of breaths. So I have to keep going back to that breathing practice. Really, I find that sometimes I do just have to pause and go. And so I am adding an extra yoga class into my week so that I can keep breathing, because that's just, it's beneficial. And I, of course, have been thinking about the bees, both those bees that I saw in that sunlight on Friday morning, and the bees of the honeybee democracy with their collective decision-making, their common understanding of what makes a good home for them, and their shared process of meeting the unknown and choosing a new form together. And so I keep thinking about, so what gets in our way? What's underneath all that conversation? And I talked about shame and vulnerability last week, and I keep coming back to that. I keep coming back to how shame is playing out in our world right now. With the definition of shame being, shame is the fear of not being worthy of real connection. It's the fear of it, not the reality of it. And I noticed that it has bothered me for a long time when there are protest signs, even for causes and positions that I agree with profoundly, when those protest signs say things like, shame on you, or you ought to be ashamed. It's just always bothered me. And rereading Brené Brown, I understand now why it bothers me. Because shame breaks down all attempts at meaningful contact or relationship. Once shame has been introduced, the possibility of real dialogue is very difficult. Shame's real goal is to prove that one is better than another, which doesn't get us anywhere. Doesn't mean we don't feel it, just as a way of being in the world. So as I watch the political season unfold, what I see is that everyone is shaming everyone all the time. That's pretty much all that's happening. Some people are doing it in stunningly blatant ways, and some people are doing it more subtly, but we're pretty much all in it now. It's the way we talk about everything, which is exhausting and demoralizing and it causes everyone to disengage in some way. Brené Brown describes the signs that shame has permeated a culture. And when she says a culture, she means a school or a family unit or a corporation or an entire nation. She says, when blaming, gossiping, favoritism, name-calling, and harassment are happening, these are all behavior clues that shame has permeated a culture. A more obvious sign is when shame becomes an outright management tool. Is there evidence of people in leadership roles bullying others, criticizing subordinates in front of colleagues, delivering public reprimands, setting up reward systems that intentionally belittle or shame or humiliate people? She says, we have to take direct action when it becomes blatant like that. And we need to remember that this doesn't happen overnight. And that shame rolls downhill, which means when leaders are shaming, this is one thing that does trickle down. It just infests everyone. And finally, she says, shame can only rise so far in the system before people disengage to protect themselves. When we're disengaged, we don't show up. We don't contribute. We stop caring. So the fact that there is the level of engagement and caring in this group of people that there is means that you are pushing against a just unbelievable mountain out there. And it means that you are wrestling with shame coming at you all the time. The interesting thing to me is that it looks like people in systems where shame is working don't behave completely rationally. Doesn't seem like a particularly bold claim, but it gets confusing about who people attach to and who people reject. So people may distance themselves from one person and attach to someone else that on the surface doesn't make any sense at all. What I think is that if someone has been shamed in one way or another, over and over, they may get very attached to a leader who is shaming other people. If shame is the dynamic that you live in, there are only two options. One is to be shamed yourself, or to shame other people. You either are being shamed or dishing it out. It's possible for there to be another way, but once you're in it, like so many things, once you're in it, it's hard to get out of the it is or it isn't, yes or no only. So it's good to stand up to a bully. It's important to start by interrupting what the lead shamers are doing, and it is just as important to start at the grassroots with the widest circle of the culture, all of the places that shame infests our lives, and see what we can do to resist the shaming. Every time we can manage to stay out of that shame or be shamed situation, we are beginning to shift things. Any time that we can minimize the fear that we or others are not worthy of connection, we begin to shift things. And this has nothing to do with political positions. I saw a short video clip recently of a judge talking to a group of young teens. I wasn't completely clear why they were in her courtroom, but she was giving them a hard time. And at first, I thought she was shaming them, and Probably there was some of that in her tone. She told them that they had to stop using whatever drug it was that they were apparently using that had brought them to her courtroom. Because if they didn't stop, they were going to end up dead or in jail. And then she said, "And I don't want that for you. You are valuable, and I want you to treat yourselves like you're valuable. I don't know you at all, but I love you, and I want you to have good lives, and you are worthy of respect." And I thought, well, now that is a fantastic speech for a judge to give young people. I want you to step out differently in the world because you are worthy of respect and love, which she was willing to give them, even though she didn't know them. I think any time we belittle our opponent or our loved ones, anytime we say that someone isn't smart or they aren't aware or they are, you popped up some words when I came around with the mic, words that we say about each other. Anytime we participate in saying that people aren't thinking or they aren't real Americans or they don't care enough or any of those things, we're actually shaming each other. We're playing into the fear that other people aren't worthy of connection. And that is something that everyone is afraid of. And so I would like us to stop participating in that. Everyone on all sides of the political spectrum is participating. And there are so many ways that it happens. Some news came out just yesterday that was particularly shaming for about half of the population. There is a practice these days there's a problem these days between police and people of color. Every time a person who is brown is stopped for just walking down the street. Or did you see the story of the man who was sitting on his porch and was arrested because somebody in the neighborhood thought someone was doing something that didn't look quite right? And so I can't explain it to you, except that a man who was brown was arrested for sitting on his porch. And the worst part of that, I think, is how shaming it is for him, that there's an indication to him that he is not worthy of connection. So we have to interrupt that. So when I say I want us to stop shaming people, I do think we have to stand up and say, that action is not acceptable. You can't do that. That's not part of how we're human together. And then we stop right there, I think. We just say, don't do that. We don't then go on, as we mostly do these days, about how awful the perpetrator of that shaming is. How you can fill in the blank with all of the words that we are all saying. Because then we've shamed them. And of course, it's tempting to think, well, that person should be ashamed of what they did. But I think what happens is that we then make reconnection impossible. And what we want, I think what we want, is for the perpetrator also to be aware and compassionate and connected and able to act on connection. And when we say things like, that's an awful person, you ought to be ashamed, it makes it almost impossible to start rebuilding the connections. Everyone's afraid that they're not worthy, and everyone's defended all the time. And I think our work is to move toward each other, move toward the person who has been deeply wronged, and move toward the perpetrator, both of them. And it's also just possible that you won't feel completely calm about doing that. And that if you consider doing it, the rant will start to rise in you. And then sometimes it just comes out. And it may not be possible to enter most situations and maintain that respect for the inherent worth and dignity of everyone. Sometimes we just lose it because it's frustrating and scary, and so we berate people. Even when we think they can't hear us, it still ripples out. And then we start to feel ashamed of ourselves, and then we all go down the rabbit hole again. So this is what I am doing, and I invite you to experiment with these two pieces of practice. One is, as I said, I have added another yoga class to my week. I never think I have time to do it. I also find that my life goes better when I'm breathing. So I'm going to that, which means all of us making a little more time for whatever the practice is, whether it's a yoga practice or just sit and breathe, or sit and watch the world, the natural world, and let that interconnectedness enter you, whatever your practice is, to recommit to it and spend more time with it. And you'll begin to see more and more about some small groups forming, which is another place for that settling, so that we can be in our best, most compassionate selves more often anyway. And the other thing is that that ranting, that agitation is going to be there. And so I think we have to find a way to work with it. Now, if you're working with Aikido or something, you may have already found a way to work with it. But the thing that John and I are doing at home is taking more time to do what I'll call exchange rants, which is to very intentionally sit down together after the 3.5-year-old is in bed, because he does not need to participate in the ranting, and take turns, just whatever is happening in our minds, whoever we need to be agitated about. And we take very intentional turns doing this. We set a timer. You don't have to be that structured about it, but it can be useful, because sometimes you get going and it's good to have something external to stop you. So one person rants, the other person just listens. Because it's not, of course, about the listener at all, and the listener can't fix it anyway. So just listen and then switch, because everybody needs a chance to let that agitation, like that breath in the cold morning, just come up and disperse. And then put the rants away and let them go. Take a couple of deep breaths and say something for which you are grateful. And then move on with your next attempt to move toward, one step at a time, move toward whoever you can.